welcome to another edition of Beyond Nitro, the monthly series which is exclusive to subscribers of adfreeshows.com. It's Guy Evans again with you, and I'm very pleased to be joined with a special guest for this month's edition of the show, and that is none other than, famously, the voice of the NWO and the former feature producer for World Championship Wrestling, along with many other accolades and accomplishments that he achieved throughout his time in the business, and that is Mr. Neil Pruitt. Neil, how are you?
You're too kind, Guy. It's great to be here and great to be part of Conrad's development of giving all the greatest wrestling information. I was privileged to be on, I think, his first podcast with Conrad by himself. And now that I'm here doing this with you is just a terrific thing to be the first interview with you guys. So this is always a great thing to talk to you folks.
Yes, and I believe that was the Insiders Conrad Show episode one was with Neil. And people can go back and look in the archives to check out that conversation, and I know that you guys covered quite a bit about how you got into the business, Neil, and your background as it relates to production and so forth. What I thought would be interesting for today's discussion would be to ask you about some of the elements of producing wrestling that, as viewers, we may not necessarily be aware of or we may not necessarily think of. So going to ask you a kind of a broad question to start, and feel free to take this in any direction that you wish. What are some of those aspects or elements of producing wrestling, whether that's in a taped environment or a live environment, that may not necessarily come to mind for the average viewer? Because I think it's safe to say it's not as simple as just turning that camera on, pointing it at someone, and then there's your show. There's a lot more involved to it than that. Is that right?
Absolutely. This is a fun subject matter for me because having done indie show types and also with the big stage internationally with WCW, I think I may have something I can contribute to someone who wants to do this on the side. I had a lot of fun doing various shows, and one of my mentors, who we talked about on our podcast, Guy and I have together, we talked about Jody Hamilton, who is the assassin, who's also famous referee Nick Patrick's father. Mm-hmm. And when I worked with him, I started out early in my career working with Jody, and I always really appreciate all his knowledge that he poured into me, and I was able to use that to further my career at WCW. But as far as one of the main things I can tell you that Jody thought was so important, which I agree with, especially when we worked together on our first go-round of Deep South Wrestling, and then, Deep South Championship Wrestling, and then later in Deep South Wrestling for WWE, where we had people like The Miz, Kofi Kingston, Luke Gallows, several other people that are on TV now, was the pacing of the show for the live audience. We never wanted to have anybody sitting on their hands waiting for the next event. Mm. I think that was something that Jody was a stickler for, that everybody's ready to go on the next match. And as soon as one thing ended, the other one started. And I think that was something that I've seen at some of the independent shows I've been to. It's been kind of a flaw where they lollygag in between. It's like, say, a rock band being up there, or a country band, and you're listening to them and they get their song done, and then all of a sudden you got to wait forever for the next one to start. I think nobody wants that. That's not the entertainment you paid for. But Jody thought that was ultra crucial. And I felt the same way, because we were there to entertain you the whole time you were there, not just part of the time. And we didn't want you sitting around in your hands waiting for something to happen. And that was something that I think was throughout my career on wherever I worked, whether it be watching WWE or working with WCW or being backstage with AEW, watching how they do their event. I mean, they're the same way. They do not like to waste time and just stand around and have somebody finally get to their position to be able to start the show again. So that's one thing that's ultra crucial that people might not see on television, because it just happens so fast when it's edited together.
Now, you mentioned the podcast that you and I produced together Neil Pruitt's Secrets of WCW Nitro, which is still active. In fact, Neil and I just recorded today a new episode of that show, so people can go and check that out. As you were saying that, Neil, something flashed to my mind, which I do recall we talked about on one of the episodes of that show. And for some reason, it's always stuck with me. And I've always kind of wanted to ask you this to follow up on what you said. It was in one of the early episodes of that show, you were talking about the importance of audio to the production process. And I distinctly remember you saying, you know, a lot of what makes good video is the audio. And that statement in and of itself kind of sounds difficult to wrap your head around until you think about it a little bit. And it actually does make perfect sense. But I distinctly remember you emphasizing that and just saying, look, you know, people don't necessarily always understand how important that audio factor is. For my benefit and for everyone else listening, could you go into that in a little bit more detail and explain what you meant by that?
I want to tell the listeners that Guy did not pass me a note. We can't even see each other while we're doing this, but in my mind I'm thinking, you know what, I'm going to talk about audio. I think audio is so important with wrestling because of the amount of punches it land and the acrobatics that it takes to actually do a good wrestling show, and the performers are out there trying their best and doing their best, and to be able to capture it audio-wise is ultra crucial. And one thing I don't know that people realize when they're doing something like an event like that is that there are several microphones positioned not only in the crowd to listen to the crowd reaction, but also on the ring itself to get those different slams and the punches. And to be able to put together a good show like we did with Deep South, where The Miz and Kofi Kingston, those that we talked about earlier, were on, it was a very low budget show, but I think people really liked it because we professionally did it, not only visually, but also we did the audio as best we could. And the way we did that was we had the announcers, Nigel Sherrod being one of them, who now is announcing with WOW, the ladies organization of wrestling that's doing so well, and also Hugh Morris, great guy Bill DeMont, who was a great wrestler with WCW and various other places. We had Ron Simmons and Teddy Long and several other people to also lend their voices to our show, which obviously gave it credibility. But we recorded the audio from their announcing separately from what we recorded the rest of the show. And I think some people don't realize that that makes for better audio, because what you're able to do then is dial up as much background noise and the punches and the crowds and everything like that to the excitement level that you want, but yet be able to hear the voices of the announcers very clearly. And also what that did was, like anything, the announcers don't always say the exact things that they should when they should say them. So sometimes I would rearrange the audio for the Deep South Wrestling show. And I was able to do that because the sound of the background was a constant rumble that was able to be a background to what the announcer said. And the reason why it was there is because we recorded that separately. So to keep the audio separate on a wrestling show or any program that you're doing, even films that when you're doing it, those are things that are crucial to making great audio. And I can tell a story about when we did a video that you may have seen where the Nasty Boys were arm wrestling in this place called the Scrap Bar. And we shot that in downtown Atlanta, and Dusty Rhodes needed a partner or a couple partners to be in a, I believe it was a 6-man tag at the time, where I think he and Dustin were going to wrestle together, and they needed the Nasty Boys' help. So they went to find out where the Nasty Boys were, and Dusty came riding up in his truck and came into the Scrap Bar, and lo and behold, he happened to see two of the Nasty Boys involved with a arm wrestling contest. And the way we did that, and to make it sound so clear, was we got there and the Nasty Boys weren't even around, and we videotaped and obviously captured audio at the same time of the background players rooting on the Nasty Boys. And they were saying, like, come on, Nasty, you know, get nasty with them, and, you know, put them to the ground, and whatever else cheers that they did. And then once the Nasty Boys came in, obviously we let the Nasty Boys talk to the people in the background for a little bit and just tell them how appreciative they were for them to hang out around at 4 o'clock in the morning to shoot this video in a bar that was closed. Once we got to actually rolling on what the Nasty Boys and Dusty had to say, we actually had the people in the background. They were mimicking as if they were talking, but they weren't. They were just totally silent. And we recorded the Nasty Boys talking and Dusty talking. And we then put that all together to make it sound exactly like we wanted as far as the level of crowd in the background, but yet hearing the voices very prominently in the foreground. So that's another way of making your films or your wrestling show sound better is the way you record it. And sometimes also that needs a little enhancement. So you may have heard or read about in the book Nitro that Guy put together so well that when Goldberg would come out, we'd also have a Goldberg chant that we actually would put into the arena, and people would hear Goldberg, Goldberg, and you know what? They would go, you know what? Hey, all the other crowd's doing it, or so they thought. So they thought they would chant along with Goldberg. So it's just one thing that kind of helps out to make the excitement a little bit better. And also when we had the Deep South show, not all the time is the crowd totally excited. I mean, these people were training to be on WWE eventually. People like MVP worked there, and we had just so many stars come through there. Jack Swagger, I mean, I could just go on and name. I'm sure I'm missing some people now. But with that, we had a rumble of the crowd that we actually did record with one of the first recorded shows that we had with Deep South. It was a match where it was a bunch of people that were in the ring at the same time, but there wasn't a whole lot of stomping going on. But there was a lot of crowd excitement. And with that excitement, then I was able to capture that and do a little bit of magical editing on that to make that last throughout all the matches that we had. They might not been that exciting, but it just lended a little bit more excitement to each match. And it's just something that you need to really pay attention to, is audio is so crucial. One of the things that we would do with WCW, when we would hire people to go out on location with us, oftentimes the first person we would hire would be someone like Mike Velosa or Terry Fitzpatrick. I mean, some of the best audio people in the business, because we knew how crucial it was. We'd actually hire the best audio people before we'd hire the cameraman, believe it or not.
So not to belabor the point, but the Goldberg chants, that would have been audio from a real crowd, right? It wasn't like you guys were getting 100 people in a studio somewhere chanting Goldberg, I would imagine.
That's correct. Goldberg, I mean, take nothing away from him. He had a big fan base, and I thought, he was able to stir excitement. And those Goldberg chants were not done because people were not so much liking him, but they were just helping them remember that they liked him. And those were from chants that were done by crowds earlier that was very exciting and just sounded terrific. So we just took the liberty to use them.
Now, it's one thing to accomplish all of these things in a sort of post-production environment or with something that's taped or recorded, but one of the things that stood out to me, at least, and I'm sure a lot of people listening, about WCW during its heyday was just the quality of the audio mix during the live programming. It almost seemed like everything just had so much clarity and just sat perfectly in the overall mix. You could hear the announcers, you heard the crowd so well that you felt like you were in the arena. Was that an observation that you shared? And if so, how were you guys and how were the people involved in doing that specifically able to accomplish that? Because I would suggest, and this is an amateur speaking now on the outside looking in, but I think the glory years of WCW really set the bar when it comes to pulling off what a live wrestling event should sound like, as well as what it should look like. So I'm curious if you share that same observation.
Absolutely, Guy, and I appreciate you being able to pick up on that, because we had the best in the business doing the audio at all times. I mean, whether it be Mother or Rick Wallace, who was instrumental in really honing the sound on exactly what we needed. Rick went on to work with ESPN on major network shows and basketball and football, and one thing, he had Joe Sparacino underneath him, and Joe then took over the reins, and we had the best audio people in the business, and also the A2s, people like Sarah Lee and people that would help out make the audio sound good backstage with Gene Okerlund, and all the walking videos that we had of Goldberg going down the hallway, those sounds, I mean, Terry Fitzpatrick and them, Mike Filosa, all the people that worked on audio, these are the best people you could hire, and they made it sound great and gave the person mixing the opportunity to do it right. And it was a constant thing where they always had to pay attention. And the way they did it was just like, you know, setting up great audio for a rock band. They just knew how to do it because they'd done it so many times, and they knew what the proper mix was. And frankly, I think they mixed for themselves and what they wanted to hear. I think we often do that in the audio business. We just mix what we like to hear, and hopefully somebody else will feel the same way. And I thought it was so terrific on the enhancement of the shows that they did things like that. And just the level of the entrance music compared to the crowd roars and the bumping noises compared to the announcers. I mean, all that, like you said, has to come and is orchestrated by one person really pulling together with a group of people that really presented them with great audio. It took a whole lot of people to make that right.
So let's talk about the visual aspect of production then. You and I have discussed in the past the fact that, you know, a lot of these iconic vignettes and videos and promos that you were involved in, the NWO most famously, you know, you were not only the voice of the NWO, so to speak, but you
New
were
World
so...
Order.
There we go. Thank you. But you were so instrumental in the look and feel of those segments. And I think you're going to get your due when this new WCW series debuts on Vice, and that's a little sneak preview for people on June 4th. You know, I think you're definitely going to get your due for the work that you did there. But if you were to take a segment like, okay, you know, Neil is going to be doing something with the NWO, with Hulk and Nash and Hall, how different was it when you compare what you were told or what was communicated to you at the very beginning, like, hey, here's what we need or here's what we're after, versus how things looked at the end? Were those two very different things, would you say?
I think so, because a lot of it had to do with just knowing the general gist of what they wanted to get across, like who they're going against and where, what kind of match it was, where did the past cross in the former parts of the shows and whatever, and then where they're trying to get to eventually. I mean, those were all things that we needed to really concentrate on. So we would kind of discuss that a little bit for the upper management, whether it be Eric Bischoff, Craig, Keith Mitchell, whoever. And then we would get together with Hogan, Hall, and Nash, and they kind of knew, after having talked to Eric, about what they needed to say. And then they would just kind of do a free-for-all, really, for about 15 minutes, talking just different phrases and things like that that they thought would be entertaining. And then it was our job to kind of figure out, okay, I liked how, say, Scott Hall said this and then Hogan said that, but we need Kevin Nash to say this to bridge those two thoughts together. So that was kind of the art of our part on how that all worked together. And then knowing visually what we can do to enhance that, whether it be show Scott Hall using the camera on Hogan and, you know, videotaping Hogan, or them using the clapper a certain way, the NWO clapper, or whatever they could do. Maybe stand behind a cage when they're in a cage match. So all those we kind of thought about and worked it out during the production or just before the production. People like David Crockett were instrumental in getting all the props and stuff like that. And we would even, you know, get messages of what we needed to say on some of the flyers that came out of the arena ceiling sometimes. I mean, it was just so... not perfectly thought out, but for a reason, because they trusted us to get the visuals that we needed, and they trusted the wrestlers to deliver the message that they needed. So we did work hand in hand together very closely with that, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion, though. It just kind of happens. After you do it so many times, you kind of know what you need to do. And yeah. The camera people really knew what we needed to get, like Bill Tinsley and, you know, Snake Tim Snyder, people like that. They really know what they needed to capture. And then the lighting, Jeff Borenstein, who does AEW now, that does their great lighting schemes for them. I mean, we all worked hand in hand together, but after you do it numerous times, you kind of know what you need. And we also, at the same time, left room for experimentation with the NWO, especially whether the background was crinkled this time or whether they're going to paint with black spray paint on the background or whatever. We got loose with that. And oftentimes we would go, say we're shooting a scene with somebody who's going to beat somebody up at a pool hall or whatever. We'd have to go into that location, see what angles we could use, what table we should choose, what props we can use. I mean, it was all one of those things where you kind of had to be confident in your crew and confident in the people you worked with, because you kind of had to make a lot of stuff up on the spot. And that was the fun part about my job and working with the great people that I did.
And do you find yourself, after a period of time, once you develop the experience necessary to do what you did, do you find yourself after a while, when you're listening to a bunch of guys like the NWO talk for 10 or 15 minutes, can you kind of hear in your head like, okay, I can see a cut here, we're going to use that, we don't need that? Is it something that emerges almost as you're listening to them say whatever it is that they're saying?
Absolutely. I know people who are announcers and were announcers in the news business, and they could hear the narration in their head and edit while they're listening. And that's kind of what you have to be good at, to know what story you want to tell.
Yeah.
And then you hear the obvious opener and, okay, I got that. That's good. Okay, that's a closer. That's a great closing line. Now we need something for the middle, you know, to kind of bridge the two thoughts together. So, yeah, I think when you're listening intently, which I think is crucial for any camera person, especially to know when to make a camera move, depending on what they're looking at, whether it be a movie or an interview or whatever, that is a crucial listening skill that you need to develop. And it comes from a lot of experience and then working with people that were able to put together a story in a package, whether it be a history package or whatever. Like when I directed that sports show when I was 25, I worked with a guy named Bo Bach. He was just a great storyteller for sports. And I think that helped me go into WCW and tell a good story. And we all know good storytellers, and you just kind of figure out, okay, how is it that they develop that story? And if you study that and really pay attention and read about it, and like even watch people like Lou Dobson, who's from NBC Today Show, he was one of the greatest at putting together those feel-good packages. And some of the things you see on CBS Sunday Morning, those kind of in-depth, happy kind of messages, and just the way they put a story together, I think you have to study that to get good at it. And that's one thing I kind of dedicated a lot of my time to do, is studying how people tell a good story. I had a grandfather, I think a lot of my people that I interacted with when I was a child, they told good stories. And I think I developed a lot of what I did through listening to them and seeing what made people react a certain way, mostly laughter around our house often. And it's just paying attention, I think, and being able to then use that technique or that thing that worked before that you saw in your videos in general. I think that helps a lot.
Now, let me ask you about how personal relationships kind of play into this, or the rapport that you develop with certain talents. Because I know in speaking with you so much over the years, Neil, and doing the podcast with you and so forth, there are certain talents that when I've mentioned them to you, I can either see or hear you light up, you know, whether it's a Roddy Piper, for example, or someone like a Macho Man. Could you tell us about who were some of your favorite people to work with on that level? And did you find that more often than not actually enhanced the final product when you're working with someone that you really enjoy spending time with and you respect on that level?
Definitely makes a better video when you're kind of on the same wavelength, I guess you might say.
Yeah.
I think Macho Man and I really had that. I think I had a good relationship with Hogan. Ric Flair was a different kind of person to work with. He kind of did his own thing, but yet he was great at it. Hogan was really terrific, of course, and he would definitely do something you suggested. And Eric Bischoff the same way. I mean, I know some of the videos that Kemper Rogers, the great editor that worked with us on the NWO look and everything, was very instrumental in a lot of the way we put that whole thing together and the look of it as well with me and several of the other people that shot the videos. I think Eric was always willing to do what it took, and he would take suggestions and do them because he knew that our best interest was his best interest and that we wanted to make the best product we could. So developing relationships with your talent and having them trust you is ultra important, and them knowing that you're going to do your best to whatever they give you, I think that makes them try harder on their end, even though they've been in the business for a very long time and professional as they are. I mean, for one of the best things I can ever remember, and I was so happy to hear from Macho Man Randy Savage, who's one of the greatest interviewers there ever was. I think one of the best characters in the wrestling business there ever was. He said, you know, I trust you, man. I want some of your verbiage, you know, give me some verbiage. He was always wanting to hear lines that we thought might entertain the people and would be in his character. And he used them, and to hear them and see them come on the air while you're watching your package later when people react to it is really a great thing to understand that good communication brought that about. And it was a whole lot of fun to see that air and know that somebody as good as they were at communicating their wrestling message took your ideas that you did to help them out and make their career even better.
Now, you told me a story once, so when I first heard it, I had to kind of do a double take because, you know, it was something I hadn't heard before, and that was your experience working with Steve Austin in WCW. And of course, he went on to become Stone Cold and just one of the biggest stars in the history of the business. But I remember you saying or talking about your experience working with him specifically as it relates to his promos and him not being the most comfortable person, you know, shall we say, in that situation, at least during that time. Would you mind getting into that a little bit and giving people a sense of what it was like in that kind of environment working with him at that time?
Yeah. Can you ever believe that Stone Cold wasn't always the most comfortable person in front of a camera, because he's gone on to just do some amazing promos, and just his podcast is just fantastic. I mean, he's just so natural at it and just so good. If you ever get a chance to hear him where he's trying to interview Sasquatch, is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my lifetime. I mean, I had tears coming down of my eyes. I remember coming back from Northeast Ohio to Atlanta, riding with my son and riding through Cincinnati, going over the Ohio River, and I was just crying my eyes out laughing at his trying to get an interview with Sasquatch one time. But just check that out. Believe me, trust me, you'll love it. But Stone Cold was really wanting to be great in the business, and, you know, we all knew he had skills and he was going to be a superstar one day. And he worked hard at it, and he really wanted to do it, and he really wanted to do great promos. But he was a little bit apprehensive as far as looking into the camera and feeling comfortable with it. So at the time, I believe he was acting as if he was the greatest professional athlete there ever was, something like that. But basically what I thought would help him was to just tell him that, look, these people that are in the audience, they don't even deserve your gaze anyway. So don't ever look in the camera. Just look everywhere else. So once you finally get comfortable with talking, with saying your message, just don't even pay attention to the camera lens. But after a while, I said, you'll get comfortable with, you know, talking right to it. And obviously he became one of the best ever, not because of what I told him, but maybe that did help him a little bit to overcome his fear. But I don't know if I'd call it fear. I'd call it maybe a little stumbling stone there for a little while.
Yes.
That didn't last very long, obviously. He went on to be one of the greatest ever. It was great to have a hand in his career. Just a little bit. Just a very little bit.
All right. Very interesting to hear about your experiences working with Steve Austin back then, Neil. And as you mentioned, he's gone on to become, or went on to become, a huge superstar. And, you know, I guess that gives people some encouragement, you know, if they find themselves in a similar position where they're struggling with public speaking or anything of that nature. You know, even the great Stone Cold had to overcome some of those stumbling blocks, as you put it.
Yeah. Another thing Stone Cold did was, I think, to get really great at what he did was work with one of the best there ever was, Cactus Jack, Mankind, Dude Love, whatever you want to call him. He and Steve would ride together, and they would not turn on the radio. All they would do is do promos, and they would do them continuously down the road, and they would just say, okay, you got a match against such and such on this date at this location, and you've had this kind of feud. Go. So it's so much about reputation in anything, and whether it be public speaking or delivering your message to a client, that's how the wrestlers do it, just how we would do it.
Well, speaking of fun, this has been, I think, a very fun episode of Beyond Nitro. Neil, as I explained to you before we started recording, we do this once a month, and we like to have some variety on the show, and it was really interesting to get into the production side of the business. And I know that really we only scraped the surface, and you know, I hope that perhaps we can do this again in the future and get into even more of the aspects of production and some of your stories and of your time working in the business. So I just want to thank you, Neil, before I let you go. And is there anything that you want to get across to the people listening to this today?
I've just been honored with the people that I got to work with. The crews that we had were the best in the business. And when you surround yourself with those kind of people, you're bound to do a good job. But those people got the way they got at their level because they did it over and over passionately. And they really concentrated on what they were doing on a day-to-day basis and learned off of other people, watched YouTube videos, I mean, saw other productions. It's a lot about reputation to get really great audio or great video. It's about doing it over and over, just to think that you can go out there and shoot it one time and have a terrific video is a misconception. You must work at it just like anything. And like I'm sure guys writing a book, when he wrote books, he wrote several essays before that maybe weren't as good as the books that are so great that he's got accolades for, whether it be in the Nitro book or Eric's Grateful or the David Pinzer book. I mean, it takes practice and it takes dedication, and that's with anything, I think, in life. So I would advise anybody who wants to do something, do it over and over, do it passionately, find out people that have done it before you that are good, and follow the way that they've done it and ask their advice.
Very good. Well, if you enjoyed this episode of Beyond Nitro and you'd like to hear even more from Neil, we definitely encourage you to go back and listen to the Secrets of Nitro archive. There's over 40 episodes where Neil is going into great detail, really unprecedented detail, about some of the more famous segments and vignettes and shoots from his time in the wrestling business. And of course, be sure to check out the series on Vice in June. And I dare say that Neil's story will come up in those episodes as well, and his contributions to WCW back in the day. And again, we hope to get Neil back on this podcast and get into more of the production side of things also. So that's it from me. And Neil, I just want to thank you again for joining us on this month's edition of Beyond Nitro.
It's always fun to be with you, Guy, and I can't wait till the next time. And say hello to Conrad for me.
Will do. Thanks so much, Neil.